Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 37, titled The Art of Dying.
Are you all ready to die? It better be, because we all are going to. That's the first thing to say, we have to face. And then, the nice thing is, though, which I discovered when I was given the job years ago of translating the so-called Tibetan Book of the Dead, is that there are no dead people. There are no dead. It's not the title of the book anyway. It's called The Book of Natural Liberation Through Learning in the Between, is what it is, the Tibetan book. The Great Book of Natural Liberation Through Learning in the Between State. And there are other translations of the book than mine, and I wasn't going to do it until, but I decided I would when I realized that I really don't like the expression intermediate state. It sounds like intermediate, you know, basket weaving or something, you know. The Tibetan word bardo just means between. And so, you know, it's really nice and catchy, you know, like when you begin the between, you know, it's like perfect. That's what happens when you die. You know, there's nobody stays dead. That's what I realized when I translated the so-called Book of the Dead. It's the book of ongoing life. And I should, you know, since I'm associated with Buddhism, I think I should first talk a little bit about it, in the sense that people always have a funny idea that it's some sort of a religion. And lately I've been giving talks, and I sort of take a pause and do a tiny prologue, even though there's never really enough time, just to say that nobody needs to be a Buddhist. It's all right to be one, but you really don't need to bother with it. But everyone needs to confront reality. It's what we need. Ignorance is not bliss. If Buddha's teaching was boiled into a few sentences, it would be ignorance is not bliss. Wisdom is bliss. Knowledge of what is real is bliss, because reality is bliss. That was his discovery, you know. When Buddha taught, "Hey, I attained nirvana," he said, I'm always so grateful that he smiled after attaining nirvana. You could attain understanding of the nature of reality, and the next thing would be, oh no, what a bummer, how awful, type of thing, couldn't it? That might, and then in that case, probably you wouldn't let on to anybody. Then you would say ignorance is bliss, so no one should change their mind. But if you discover the nature of reality and you find that reality of yourself and the world around you buoys you in an ocean of bliss, then you'll be grinning, you know, then you'll be happy. And then if you look around and you see that people also are in the same ocean, everyone is, but the people are like feeling, what is the ocean? I might drown in it. And they're like clinging to their boundary. They're fighting off the rest of it. They want more of it because they feel overwhelmed by this vast size of it all. And so they are totally engaged in being themselves, their real selves, and not being other people. And that, of course, puts you in a terrible situation. You're just yourself. And who else? And by once you think you're yourself, of course you feel you should worry about yourself. You should take care of yourself. And you kind of secretly think, as you grow older, when you're younger it's obvious, but whether you get secretly think, well, since the only thing I'm sure of is myself, that must be the most important thing. And then you notice nobody else thinks so. Unless they're temporarily in love with you. Mom thought so briefly for a little while when it was still mother's gold. And then after it wasn't mother's gold anymore, she didn't necessarily think so. So that's all it is, you know, that it's our ignorance is that we exaggerate our own separate status in the world, and we struggle with that world, and we try to fend it off, and we deal with it. And then that's why death is such a trauma for us, because death is where we can no longer maintain that boundary, we can no longer fend things off, we can no longer possess things and feel that there's a little bit more because we own some things, or we have some relationships, or we have this or that, and even we don't get to keep our body. And so that's why it's such a huge thing for us, you know, the death transition. But it's only a transition. It's the caterpillar becoming a butterfly, or whatever, the cocoon becoming a butterfly, you know. Hopefully. It could be a cocoon becoming a worse cocoon, unfortunately, if people are too clutched up about their cocoon. And because in a way people get what they want. If they just want to be a really closed cocoon, then unfortunately they can move into a more closed embodiment. So that's the thing. Now, that's my sort of contribution. You know, I'm not one of these brave people who many of you, I think, probably are. And I want to say that I admire every single person here. Coming here, maybe some of your friends, when they heard, oh, I'm going to New York. Well, what are you going to do in New York? You're going to go to the Lion King? No way. I'm going to Art of Dying. And say, oh, are you all right? Are you okay? What's going on? And you say, yeah, I'm good. Because, you know, dying is something great, actually, you know. Dying is, you know, the French, who, you know, they're into pleasure a little bit in Paris, they call an orgasm a petit mort, the little death. So if that's a little death, what's the big death? You know? But of course, not for someone who's desperately hanging on to themselves and they can't let go of themselves. Then, of course, when they're forced to let go of themselves, it becomes a struggle. So the thing is that death is this, simply this transition. So you are smart to come. That's right. You are great because you're smart to come and look at this. You know, the very great Eckhart Tolle, one of our great teachers of our culture, helped a lot of people by getting them out of all their anxieties and their bitterness over the past and their anxieties over the future and into the moment. But actually, in a way, what the moment is like death also. It means you die to the past and future when you really come to the moment. And then they found out that that made them feel more alive by compressing things down to the moment. But the key about the moment of death is that it expands into vast possibility. So really what coming to the moment is just like confronting death. Like, for example, in the Buddhist tradition, all spiritual traditions, you know, some of those monks in the West, they have a skull in their room, you know, and they look at the skull, right? And they talk to it, and they remind themselves that they are it. Milarepa, the great St. Francis of Tibet in the 12th century, he used to say, I don't know why people are so afraid of corpses. I live with one, meaning himself, you know, meaning his body was not, he realized that his body was a potential corpse, you know, and therefore he was not attached to it that much, although, of course, his body was very amazing. He was an amazing yogi. So I congratulate you for being here. I think it's really, really wonderful. It's a joyful thing to look at death. So the Tibetans say there are three routes to the awareness of death that will really bring you to life. And the first of them is to really realize that you're definitely, you yourself as an individual, are definitely going to die. And we say, well, wait a minute, I know that. Why should that be something to meditate on? That's called the first route. Well, because if you really meditate on it in a critical way, which is the most important kind of meditating, just emptying your mind is not really very important, although it's calming and it's good for your blood pressure and it's helpful, but it won't change things that much. But critical meditating is very powerful. And when you do this and you critically meditate on, I know I am definitely going to die, and then you will realize right away that you are actually living, running around in denial of that fact. And you're talking about, well, I'll go to the Art of Dying next year because this year I'm really busy and I got to go over there and do this and the other. Or I'll do something really important next time or after I retire or after I finish making my next million or whatever it is. And you're always assuming you're going to be there. And we live in denial of that fact. So when we realize that we're definitely going to die, what it does is it means every moment of life is really important. And what is my life? And what is its meaning? What is its purpose? And am I using it in the best possible way? And then the second route is called the uncertainty of when it will be. Any moment could be our last. And then when we learn to live like that, you know, I don't know, Putin could drop a nuclear weapon on us any time. We're near Times Square. They bored with Times Square. They don't have the same electronics in Moscow and Red Square. And they might be annoyed. We could all be obliterated any second, as far as our bodies go. But we would not be obliterated, you know. Obi-Wan Kenobi would be upset. There would be a disturbance in the Force if we were all suddenly obliterated. But that disturbance would be us seeking new bodies. We'd be blasted into light smithereens right away, but the mind is capable of that. Mind does not need its atoms. The mind is beyond those things, but in a way it also connects to them, so it would find more atoms, you know, the mind. You can't blow up the mind with a nuclear weapon, actually. You really can't. Now, of course, you think that's some nice sort of thing. So then, the third route, so that's the second route. So those two routes about, I'm definitely going to die, so my life is really precious. It could be any time, so therefore every moment is really precious. This is a way of really waking up. But then the question comes, when I die, what is it that goes on with me? What goes on? What is my soul? What is my spirit? What is my mind? This becomes a question. And, of course, the funny thing is everyone knows they have one. That we do know. I have a mind. We know that. We say, well, do you have a mind? Yeah, I have a mind. Everyone knows that. Except our materialist scientists. They don't know that. They keep trying to prove to us that we're just a bunch of neurotransmitters, we're a biological robot, we're a bunch of wetware brain running around, bouncing around in a skull cage, and that we don't really exist. Do you realize that? That is the discovery of modern science. Did you realize that? That we do not really, truly exist? It's like more far out than Buddhism, boy. Here we are, and nobody here exists. We think we do, because the brain is doing things and making you think so. And the neuroscientists can come and put a thing on and say, oh, yeah, you're alive because your brain is going zip, zip, zip. And Evan Alexander is the only guy lately who became a traitor to his brotherhood by having some experience when his brain wasn't working. Of course, they think he's just hallucinating, he's crazy, and they think they're sane. They actually think they're sane. And why? Because they've discovered... Scientists only promote what they have discovered, right? That's what science is. You look at reality, then you discover something, and then you say, this is what's there, right? Isn't that what it's supposed to be? So guess what they discovered? Nothing. They have discovered that you, when you die, are going to be nothing. And actually, that means you really are nothing right now, because you just shoot yourself, and then nothing reveals itself. Oblivion. That's you. So that means they feel they have discovered that. I once met a guy at Bellevue. I wasn't an inmate yet, but I met him, and because he wanted to get the Dalai Lama there to put him in his fMRI machine. And I said, well, don't get him, but get one of these yogis who can go out of body in meditation. They leave their body in cataleptic trance, and their mind goes out like a waking dream in meditation. And that would be interesting to see what the brain is doing when the mind is elsewhere and doing something. He said, don't ever say that. Don't say that in this place. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we know when there's nothing in the brain, person doesn't exist. We know that. I said, how do you know that? Well, I put corpses in my fMRI, and there's nothing happening in there. So I know there's no mind there, he said. I said, okay, I'll never mention it again. I promise. And it took me a couple of days to overcome, because the gentleman was very expressive. You know, it was like, don't say that. And it was like, and you know, they're like a high priest. They're like an authority, these kind of people. And so I was quiet for a day or two. And then I was in a taxi on 96th Street and Lexington Avenue going over to meet some people. And I suddenly burst out laughing. And my driver wondered, what was my problem, you know? And he thought maybe I'd found Allah or something. And he said, why are you laughing? I said, well, I'm laughing because one of these great scientists who is expecting a Nobel Prize thinks that he has discovered nothing and he wants a prize. The reason I'm saying this is not just to tease the scientists, but it is to help you and me. And because this is the really important meditation. If anything I have to say to you tonight, this is a really important one. And that is, we brought up in a culture which we get not from our churches or synagogues or mosques or Buddhist temples or Hindu temples, whatever it is, but we go from our science classes and from the common sort of supposed common sense of the culture, you know, MIT, Harvard, Columbia. We think that we do not exist. When we die, that's the end of it. And we're told that we're random mutations, that's we're an accident, and that there's no soul, and that's some crazy old religious thing that the priests cooked up to get taxes, you know, to get donations every Sunday or Friday or whatever religion it is, Sabbath, and that we do not really exist. And although we may have some spiritual ideas, and we come to the Open Center to be spiritual, there's a deep underlying thing that those are the authorities and they must know. They really know, and therefore, oh, we better get whatever we can get done in this life, because it's the end of it. And therefore, when we do the dying thing, art of dying, or hospice, or whatever, all that is helping someone just become unconscious, which they will then be permanently. So it's just sort of how to die is how to painlessly get out of the body, because once you're dead, you're over, and that's it. So what that's a tremendous, in ancient India, all Buddhists, Hindus, Jains, all of the different religions there used to argue with each other about everything, but the one thing that they agreed about was whenever people would come to believe that they are essentially nothing, meaning that their continuum of consciousness ends at death, when the body ends, those people would have no motivation to do any sort of positive spiritual thing beyond just temporary, like a little nicer here, a little more cheerful there, some nicer somebody. But in the long run, there's no consequence to your life, good or bad, if you just get out of it and there's no consequence. So, you know, you won't really try that hard to make it that good. Do you follow me? And unfortunately, we notice on this planet, the dominant culture of the planet, modern materialist culture, doesn't really work very hard not to be bad. And it's riven with violence, and we're destroying the entire planet. Because why? The people making the decisions, the big bosses, the oil companies, the people like denial, global warming, and unrealistic people like that, they feel, I'm not going to be there when the ocean comes up Fifth Avenue. And so my Park Avenue duplex that I live in, from selling a bunch of crappy coal and oil and petroleum and pumping it around, and then someone else will be there in the lobby getting the flood. You know, I'll be gone. Even our president said that to Rod Woodward, when Woodward said, "Don't you feel bad, you know, messing up the environment like you did in Texas and stuff like that? And your grandchildren will think you polluted and you did this and that." And he said, "Oh no, I don't care about that, because I won't be there. Whatever they think, I won't be there." So that's the underlying, and he's supposed to be born again. Where does he think he'll be? He'll be there. He'll be up with Jesus saying, "We'll make a new planet." No. This is an underlying thing that we have, where we feel that, and in a way, it's frightening to come around with the opposite, which is, death is just like going to sleep, and then you're going to wake up. And the way in which you wake up has to do with how you have lived today. You know, you could wake up unhappy, unhealthy, miserable. And, of course, the death is a much bigger one because you don't have the material continuity of your cells and your flesh, etc. At that time, your mind is like you're in a dream. The between state is like a dream. And then, however you configure your embodiment in the dream, that will determine the kind of embodiment that you will find, you know, rebirth. We call it rebirth. Reincarnation we reserve for those who can lucidly die and take rebirth, like lucid dreaming, right? How many of you here can lucidly dream? Come on, you're Open Center people. I knew there'd be a few people. Excellent. That's training for the between state. That's one of the most important trainings for the between state, to be conscious of your very subtle mind in a condition where you're guiding what you want to do, and yet you stay there with the subtle mind. You don't immediately wake up because you're conscious that you're dreaming. And if you can lucidly die, then you can be born where you like. I think it's a book. My publisher wants me to write a book that I've been thinking about for a long time. It's what we call how to take rebirth on Fifth Avenue. Meaning knowing, going where you want to go, you know. Nice house, nice apartment, nice mom, performing what the Buddhists call a successful womb shot. That's what it's called. It's not a moon shot, it's a womb shot. And that's what happens according to, you know, Sigmund Freud would have freaked. with joy if he had ever read the Tibetan so-called Book of the Dead or the Book of Natural Liberation, where you have a kind of Oedipal or Electra experience before you're conceived, which means that, you know, as you in your lucid dying, which is your lucid dream state or between state, you're cruising up and down Fifth Avenue, Third Avenue, First Avenue, and you see through walls in that condition because you're this very subtle body-mind, and then there are all these couples getting it on, as there tend to be, and then there's one that you particularly like. And if you want to be reborn as a male, you really like the female, and your kind of dad could do without. You want to replace the dad. And if you're going to be reborn as a female, you just as soon replace the mom. And then what happens is you pass out, and you end up in the zygote. The meeting is really quite patriotic. No, it's patriotic. The mother's seed is red. The father's seed is white. And your subtle body-mind is a deep, dark blue, they say. A very deep sapphire blue. And it lands in the middle of this red and white union. So it's red, white, and blue. And that's your new embodiment. But if you don't know, if you don't have a lucidly rebirth possibility, then you don't know where you'll end up. And if you romantically, we had a lama who used to live with us in Amherst, and he was very upset about Miss Piggy. He liked her a lot. And, you know, when he saw the children watching Miss Piggy, but he was very upset about it because he said, this is very worrisome because some child who might prematurely die or something who was really into Miss Piggy, when that being died due to some accident or getting sick prematurely or something, they would be cruising in the between state driven by blind impulse, and they might be looking for Miss Piggy, and they might be reborn in a pigsty. And it wouldn't be as much fun as with Miss Piggy on whatever program she was on. And we said, Rinpoche, it's not so bad, you know. You have such animal stories in the Buddhist literature in ancient time. People were reborn as animals. Buddha had many previous lives as Lassie the dog and as the nice lion and the nice tiger. They had that kind of story. And he said, yeah, but they weren't on TV in multicolor. Hours at a time imprinting someone's brain. He said, it's just a story that we tell. So that's the unconscious way of death and dying, you know, of dying and being reborn. So training for the art of dying is also the art of entering the between and art of entering the next life. And that's really key. And in a way, it's both encouraging, you know, the people who are materialists and who think they're being really big and grown up to be embrace nothing, you know, the existentialist sort of thing. And they think that people with the reincarnation idea are sort of silly and simplistic, and they just want to always go on the way they are, you know, play golf in the next life or whatever, you know. And they're brave to realize, to think of being nothing, you know. But that's completely self-delusion. You can think about it for a second. Come on. If that was the case, nobody could ever fall asleep. Every night you are thrilled to become oblivious. You know, you don't want to be oblivious right now, or maybe I'm already driving you to that point, but otherwise, normally you like to stay conscious and do things, but when you've been up 10, 12, 15 hours, zonk, you want to be out. And, you know, you would count on waking up, of course, because we live in denial of death, of our own death, or it could happen any time type of thing, but we welcome oblivion. So, you know, oblivion is not the worst option at all. So the much more worrisome to someone would be that if I do face future life and I don't know how to live, or I've been unpleasant in this life, or I am afraid a lot and I am very nervous and so forth, what will be the quality of your future life? That becomes quite an issue, you know. And it's not a matter that, you know, the Darwin and these kind of people were mad with the fire and brimstone Christian preachers who were sending everybody to hell if they didn't do this and didn't do that. And so that's why they're so scared of the idea of having a future life. But it's not that. It's a matter of your own evolutionary skill and your own evolutionary orientation. What do you really want? What is your desire, you know? What kind of a being do you want to be? And once you get that idea, you then start shaping yourself in this life. You become a yogi or yogini of shaping your life better. And you realize that you start having a stake in being generous, for example. Because being generous is what? It's a rehearsal for letting go of things. You give, you know, you open your heart. Oh, here, you have it. Oh, I love that thing. But here, you love it too, and I enjoy your having it, you know. So that's a rehearsal for when you die, you have to let go of your body. When someone else is nasty to you or something, when you resist the temptation to be reactive and freak out and be nasty back, and you say, gee, what's your problem? You know, and you manifest patience. Then that's also letting go of sort of a gut impulse reaction. You know, so you see suddenly your life as a rehearsal for gaining a better life, if you follow me. And you can do that. You can count on the fact that when you shape your life, it will be shaped. Just like you go to the gym, you know, you lift a weight or whatever, and your arm shapes itself well. You do your yoga, and you feel better. You don't have the same problem with your joints. Then you ease the potential of your rheumatism and all kinds of other horrible things. Sciatica and all this thing from sitting all the time by doing a little stretching. You know, you do so you can shape your body in this life. You know that. And you can shape your mind in this life. And you're all open. So you've been at the Open Center and you're at Art of Dying, so you all know that. So that goes on forever. What do you think? That's a different perspective, isn't it? There's a second element to that different perspective, by the way, which is not only do you go on forever, but everybody else you know does too. And you're going to meet them all again. And this is my favorite. Don't be too mean to your ex, because you're going to fall in love with him or her again. And if you were too rough in the divorce settlement, you might have a problem in the next one. So you're never rid of anybody. You're going to be dealing with them all of the time. This then leads to what they call the bodhisattva mind, the altruistic mind. You realize you have to bring others along with you into a better way of living, because you're never going to get rid of them. It's like you guys are never going to get rid of me. Ralph is going to chase me off here in a little while, and you'll get a calmer person. But you're going to be at my lecture another time, another life. I've been at your lecture a lot of times. And somehow we didn't give each other still the right lecture, because we're not all enlightened yet. Although we're getting there. We are getting there. We're in a lucky time talking about Art of Dying. We really are in a lucky time. But this takes effort, you understand? It doesn't help, for example, just to say, okay, I believe in reincarnation. Because if you meditate about it, you realize that somehow the way you live, you kind of are only living with what the Tibetans, the Indians, the Chinese, the Japanese call living for the purpose of this life. You only feel that whatever you do will give you a result in this life. You don't feel that you don't make decisions you make a decision about your pension, about your long-term care insurance, whatever, but you don't make it, but your future life insurance, you don't take out future life insurance. Because it's not really viscerally part of your thing. It takes effort to realize what is really the big shift, you know? Oprah had a big shift when Eckhart Tolle explained to her about being in the moment. Everything shifted. But the really big shift is next step. That is a big shift. But the really big shift is next step. Is that moment is the seed of an infinite future. That you're going to be there forever. Then if you like, I wrote a book called Infinite Life, which I like, actually. And I like the title. And my editor hated it. And she said, you can't put it that title, and that's crazy. And all kinds of reasons they tried to stop me from using the title. And finally they said to me, you're not going to go around promising people infinite life, are you? And they thought they nailed me with that one. I said, no, I'm going to go around threatening them with infinite life. Because if you have infinite life, how that life will be becomes an infinite concern. It better be a good one. For yourself and others. And it really does become, it's like you don't just go to Kennedy Airport and just jump on any plane and go anywhere with no passport, no wallet, no shots, no nothing. No way. You prepare very carefully for your journey. You book a passage. You book a hotel. You whatever it is you have to do, you do. So you should be booking your next life. Definitely. And actually, when someone's dying, because there's a lot of wonderful people here who help people die and deal with it, and it's so important that we do that. In America, we're in denial about death, all of us, because we're a militarist, violence-ridden society. And we like that because we're reckless types. We're devil-may-care because we think the worst thing that can happen to us is just we become obliterated. That's the worst. And we don't even mind that. We ask for anesthesia when we're in pain, obliterating our sensitivity. But, and so so that's one of our problems as a nation, is that we're built on this system that just this life, just what I get out of it, so I can be reckless and careless. Because I can just be devil may care, we say. We say devil may care, like, because we don't think there is a devil. We don't. Okay, so I just wanted to tell you there is such a thing as spiritual science. There's Buddhist science, there's other spiritual traditions have sciences. As scientists, it has been discovered there's a huge evidence for your future life, for everyone's in past life and future life. Enormous evidence. It isn't just Pim Van Lommel. It isn't just Evan Alexander. There's an enormous evidence for it. So many people who remember previous lives and can identify things. It's a huge database, not only the Ian Stevenson one in Virginia, but also all over Asia. Such a huge database. And I mean, scientists, if they were really objective scientists and not just dogmatists, materialist dogmatists, they would examine this evidence. Sometimes they might reject some particular one, but they can't pretend there is none, which is what they do, which is what the way dogmatists behave. And if you know that there's a scientific, you know, it's like people get up and they give these lectures, you know, and they have a thing there and they show a brain and then they say, eat this food or take this pill and there's your brain. And you know, everyone gets, okay, right, we like that because it seems to prove it to us. But nobody's going to prove. And the one thing you know they will never prove, that there is such a thing as nothing. That will never be proven. Do you realize that? That cannot be discovered. Who can discover nothing? Did you ever find nothing? You say sometimes when you're looking for something, you say, oh, there was nothing there. But then if someone says, well, did you find the nothing there? You don't say that unless you're cracked. Oh, yeah, okay, I got the nothing now. You don't say that. And even I always like to trick audience and say, who's afraid of nothing? And some people will go like this. And then I say, if the real Rambo stood up and said, I'm afraid of nothing, what would you think he meant? So how can you be afraid of nothing? It means you're not afraid. It's nothing to be afraid of. Right? So anybody who believes they're going to be nothing has the absolutely worst form of blind faith that could possibly exist. Much more sensible to believe in God or goddess or whatever. That's a step better. Although we shouldn't blame any one being for the mess of the world. God himself asked Buddha to tell people that he, the Brahma, you know, an Indian creator, that he didn't make the mess. He tries to do his best to help people, but he's not omnipotent. Nobody, no one being can be blamed for it all. We're all participants in any kind of messes that we are. But then luckily, ultimately, it's not a mess. It's fine. It's the clear light of the void. So when death is defined in Buddhist science as when all consciousness boils itself down from all the central nervous, from the coarse body of the senses and the sense environment, the subtle body of the central nervous system and the kind of dream environment of the subtle mind and body, down to what's called the clear light of the void, down through layers of moonlight, sunlight, and darkness. And then, but it doesn't end with darkness. That's weird, that we wrongly think. Like when you fall asleep, I bet you think you just lie in a dark state because you go into darkness, right? You turn off the light, right? You go dark. But actually, where you fall is into the clear light of the void, what they call, which is something like transparency, like a diamond-like transparent thing. That's why you feel refreshed in the morning. Would you feel refreshed if you lay in a bed of nothingness? Where would the energy that refreshes your cells come from if you lay in a bed of nothingness? You lay in the clear light of the void, the infinite loving energy, loving in the sense of ready to be drawn upon to satisfy any need, loving energy of the universe. That's what Buddha discovered, called clear light of the void or nirvana, you know? So every night you go to sleep, you guys are snoozing in nirvana. Because why? Because that is your reality. And your ignorance is shut down because your consciousness is closed, has gone to rest. So you're not making a boundary between yourself and the rest of the universe. You're just floating in the universe. You're trusting. You have to trust to fall asleep, right? Anything could happen to you when you're asleep. And you sort of trust and you let go of your boundary. And when you let go of your boundary, you're in the clear light of the point. And that's why you feel happy in the morning. That's a yoga. That's sleep yoga. Anyway, I will teach that tomorrow in workshop. I'm sure I'm nearly running out of time, or I may have. But just come on, shut me up whenever time comes. Otherwise, I never shut up, unless my wife is there and she goes like this. Then I do. So I think that was mainly what I wanted to share with you. All of these kind of, there are these six betweens. There's the life between. When you realize that death is just a between, death is just the doorway which you go out of, and nobody stays in the doorway. They go from one room to another. It's where the mind gets to clear light, and then clear light has this infinite energy and sort of skids in all directions. But then the normal unenlightened person is driven by an unconscious that's filled with impulses of lust and hate, eros and thanatos, and it just goes after this and fears that and finds another thing similar to a boundary body to re-embody itself. But if one realizes that one has become conscious of the unconscious, which is the yogi and yoginis enterprise of a meaningful life, where you have no unconscious impulse to drive you, the energies that normally drive people as unconscious impulses become energies you can surf. Your greed becomes what they call the ruby light of discriminating awareness seeking beauty. And you just skid along on that red light, on that red energy. Your envy, your natural tendency to envy others, be competitive with them, and think of them as better, becomes the light of accomplishing miracles. The green emerald energy, etc. I'll give that more in detail tomorrow. I don't have time to do that tonight. So that's it. You are here forever. We're here together forever. We have already been. They have a meditation where you meditate, everyone in previous life has been your mother. All of you are my mom. You were. I apologize. I've been a brat in many lifetimes. I have. And I've been your mom, and I forgive you. But I don't really want to do it again, and I don't want to foist myself on you again in that same way. So let's all become enlightened. Let's embrace the grace of the clear light of the void. And let's just choose consciously where to go to help other beings and to be joyful and blissful ourselves. By the way, the only way you can really realize the clear light of the void, the deepest level of reality, the luminous, deep, diamond-like transparency of reality, the only kind of subjectivity that can actually recognize it is the subjectivity of bliss. That is to say, you have to melt into it through bliss. Because it's not an object apart from you. So how do you come to know something that is also your knowing energy, your knowing mind? Both the knowing mind and a sense of an objective around the knowing mind have to melt together. And the only way to do that is bliss. And everybody knows that. You know that you're good when you're feeling blissful, right? You've all been blissful, right? Are you blissful? You've all been blissful. And it's known in the culture. Have you ever seen the Zoloft commercial? Have you ever seen it? There's that lady, she's in a kitchen, and the dog is doing something horrible on the floor. Baby's throwing the food on the floor. Husband is in there like, where's my coffee? And she's burning the absolute horrible Monsanto waffle in a disgusting, cooker. And she's going, like this, right? And it's just really bad. And she looks out the window of this suburban home, and there in the field are these yellow flowers poking up. And then the yellow flowers jump out of the grass, and they form in yellow letters, golden letters, Zola. And then you can tell she took one because she's, boom, bam, new Moffat here, get your, dog, get out, husband, make your own coffee, everything's cool. She's just totally sailing on top of it. Because they're selling her that that's bliss in that Zoloft. So they know that's what everyone wants. That's it. And they're pretending that it's a material thing that you can get by taking a pill, which is not true. In fact, you can get a little stimulation, but then you have a bad side effect, Anyway. Okay? So that's it. I think that's probably the time I see here. And I think I gave you what I want. But I want you to know that science tells you, that is, reality tells you, what you think today, what you do today, whether you gesture this way or that way to your friend in a conscious, nice way. It's a tiny example, last thing. The great Shantideva, one of the great sages and saints and enlightened people of ancient India of the 8th century, he said, if anybody ever asks me for directions, I will never point out the way to go with the one finger like this. Like someone says, where's the bathroom? I will never go, it's over there. Because when you do that, you're sort of bossing the person, right? You're showing you that I know and you don't, and this is like a sort of control thing to put your finger like that. He says, what I will do is I will use my whole hand and I will gesture like this, like inviting an honored guest. And I will say, the bathroom is over there. And that will affect their future life with you. When they meet you in the next life, they'll really like you. They'll feel like that person was a gracious host. They didn't think of themselves as above me and bossed me around. When I wanted to go somewhere that they knew, they invited me to go there. This is the sign. This kind of thing is the sign of enlightenment. Okay? So make nice gestures, make nice smiles to each other. And I'm so honored to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. And on with the show, Thomas Moore will come up, I think. Ralph is going to introduce, I imagine. And thank you very much. Remember, there are no dead people.